Robert Fulghum tells this story where he was working in his study, and there were some kids in the neighborhood playing hide and seek. And they had this fantastic, amazing game of hide and seek. And there was one kid who found a hiding spot in the bushes right underneath his study window. It was the perfect hiding place. No one could find him. And this game went on for a long time, and this kid stayed hiding. And in fact, the game went on for so long, and the kid was hiding for so long, that the other kids kind of stopped playing the game, and they went on to whatever they did next. And the kid was still hiding. And finally, Robert Fulghum opened up his window, kind of reached out and said, "For God's sake, kid, get found." I wonder if we have it backwards. We often hear about our faith that it's all about seeking God. What if it is actually about being found? Letting yourself be found. What if we worried less about, you know, what do we need to do to get to heaven? And just trust God with all that stuff. And we awakened that heaven is already in us. And when we awaken that heaven is already in us, then we participate with God in bringing heaven to earth, particularly for those people who are experiencing a living hell. We're continuing our series on Beyond Cathedrals, and what we're doing is marking the 500th anniversary of the Reformation by entertaining the idea that we are in the midst of the new Reformation, that something new is taking place, that we're in the midst right now as we sit and as we speak, in the midst of a spiritual awakening, a shift, a reemergence. I hear all the time, it's hardly across my Twitter feed or books that I read, hardly a day goes by where somebody doesn't bemoan the fact that the church is dying. I actually don't think the church is dying. I think something new is trying to be born. I truly believe God is trying to do something new if we would just allow it to happen. So last week, Morgan and I talked about three movements that are part of this new Reformation, three, what Brian McLaren calls three migrations. We talked about the spiritual migration, and the spiritual migration is when you move from seeing Christianity as predominantly about getting your beliefs right to seeing Christianity as a way of life, a way of love shown to us in Jesus. And then there's a missional migration. And the missional migration is moving from organized religion, and because we tend to be organized around the wrong things, and we tend to be organized in such a way that much of our energy is spent in trying to preserve and save the institution. And instead, we become an organizing religion, organizing ourselves to save the planet, organizing ourselves to overcome poverty and injustice, organizing ourselves to be peacemakers, to do something to end the senseless violence that happens again and again and again. And today, theological migration. I want to spend a little bit of time on a shifting theology. And moving, I guess, from an image of God as God is a supreme being out there, over there, kind of hard to please, easily angered, judging, watching, to the image of God as a ceaseless flow of love from which we can never be separated. That shift, that theological shift, I think is a shift from what I call a transactional faith, which is really the paradigm of most of Christianity, to a transformational faith. Jesus told a story in Luke 15. And before I read the story, a little bit of background. Jesus loved to hang out with sinners, and he loved to eat. Not a bad combination. And in the first century, eating was really important. In the first century, eating was not just a social activity, it was actually a spiritual and a political activity. In fact, in the first century, who you ate with said a lot. In fact, there were leaders that were part of the religious establishment, and they were the ones that got to determine who got to eat with who. The leaders of the religious establishment got to determine who was clean and who was unclean, and who was acceptable and who was unacceptable, who was righteous and who was unrighteous. Oh my gosh, I wish I could say that here we are in 2017 and the religious establishment has changed. But we still like to determine and categorize who's acceptable to God and who's not. So eating in the first century was called table fellowship. And those, if you happen to be sitting next to someone at the table, you essentially were saying, you're okay. You're right with God. Because God knows I'm right with God, so if you're sitting next to me, you must be right with God too. And those who were kept away from the table, who were unclean, who were unacceptable, they were called sinners. See, in the first century, that had a different connotation. It wasn't necessarily what you did. It was who you were. It was your category. You were the excluded ones. You were the unclean, the unacceptable ones. Well, Jesus ate with sinners. If you look throughout all of the Gospels, the man was dining all the time with folks. Now, either he's like me and he just liked to eat, or he was making kind of radical, revolutionary, dramatic statements by who he ate with. He ate with the sinners. He ate with the outcasts. He ate with the prostitutes. He ate with the tax collectors. Anyone and everyone who was excluded by the religious establishment, he ate with. So then you have these religious leaders who go to Jesus because they're incredibly offended by this guy who is not only hanging out with sinners, he's eating with them, and in eating with them, it makes him unclean. So Jesus doesn't argue with them. Have you ever tried to argue with somebody who's kind of self-righteous in their sense of their rightness? Have you tried that? Not very effective. So instead, Jesus tells a story, a parable. Now, you might remember a couple weeks ago, I said a parable. The word parable literally means to throw alongside. So rather than arguing straight one-on-one, Jesus tossed a story alongside. And if you're going to catch the truth of the story, you have to move. You have to kind of let go of your assumption of what you think you already know and move to catch it. So as I read the story from Luke 15, which is the about a father and two sons, I'm guessing the majority of you right now already think you know what the story means. Let that go. Imagine you're one of those religious leaders. Imagine you're one of those religious leaders who right now you're just deeply offended by Jesus. You know, you're holding on to this theology of a God who has a lot of rules and is easily angered. So, this isn't the Bible, because it is the Bible, but the print on this is way larger than my Bible, so it is the Bible. Luke 15, the tax collectors and sinners, they gathered all around to hear Jesus. The leaders of the religious establishment muttered under their breath, "This man welcomes sinners and eats with them." Jesus told a story. There was a man who had two sons. The younger one said to his father, "Father, give me my share of the estate now." So the father divided his property between the two sons. Not long after that, the younger son got together all he had. He set off for a distant country, and there he squandered his wealth in wild living. After he'd spent everything, there was a severe famine in that whole country, and he began to be in severe need. So this younger son went and hired himself out to a citizen of that country who sent him to his fields to feed pigs, making himself more unclean than anybody could be unclean. He longed to fill his stomach with the pods that the pigs were eating, but no one gave him anything. When the younger son came to his senses, he said, "How many of my father's hired servants have food to spare? Here I am starving to death. I will set out and go back to my father and say to him, 'Father, I've sinned against heaven and against you. I'm not even worthy to be called your son. Can you at least make me like one of your hired servants?'" So the younger son got up and went to his father. But while he was still a long way off, his father saw him. His heart was filled with love for his son, and he ran out to his son and immediately threw his arms around his son and he kissed him. The son said, "Father, I've sinned against heaven and against you. I'm not worthy to be called your son." The father wasn't even listening. Said to his servants, "Quick, bring the best robe and put it on him. Put a ring on my son's finger, sandals on my son's feet. Bring the fattest calf and kill it. Let's party and celebrate. For this son of mine was dead and is alive. He was lost and is found." So they began to party. Meanwhile, the older son was out in the field. When he came near the house, he heard music, dancing. So he called one of the servants and asked him, "What's going on? Your brother's come home. Your father has killed the fattest calf because your brother's home safe and sound." The older brother was angry. He refused to go in. His father came out, pleaded with him. But he told his father, "Look, all these years I've been saving for you, never disobeyed your orders, yet you never gave me even a young goat so I could party with my friends. But when this son of yours, who has squandered your property with prostitutes, comes home, you kill the fattest calf for him? My son," the father said, "you are always with me. Everything I have is yours. We have to celebrate and be glad because this brother of yours was dead and is alive again. He was lost and is found." So father had two sons. The youngest son says, "Give me my inheritance now." Now, if you're dreaming up something you could say to your father in the first century patriarchal society, you could not have said anything more offensive than that. And in the first century patriarchal society, respect for your elders, particularly your male elders, was everything. So when Jesus was telling this story to these religious leaders, the first, right off the bat, when the son said, "Hey, I want the inheritance now," because that's essentially saying, "Dad, I just assumed you were dead." So right off the bat, these leaders are offended. But do you know what's really offensive? The father says yes. That shocked them. So then this son goes off and he wanders away from home and he squanders everything on wild living, and then he realizes, even my father's servants are better off than I am right now. So notice he's not necessarily motivated by a deep sense of remorse and a hope to return to his father's fold. He's at least hoping to get into the servants' barracks. That's his hope here. So he begins his journey home. Now I can imagine, my imagination, as he's beginning his journey home, he's kind of rehearsing his apology. Have you ever done that? You know, you're rehearsing your apology, kind of going through it in his mind, you know, trying to kind of, okay, I need to look really remorseful. And he's kind of thinking it through, okay, this is what I'm going to say. And I hope to at least get in my father's servant's barracks. But what it says, the father sees him. And the father runs out, races out to greet him. And then what it says, before the son could even open his mouth, the father wraps his arms around him and says, "Welcome home, let's party." The father didn't say, "Told you so." The father didn't say, "Have you learned your lesson?" The father didn't say, "Now show me that you're remorseful, that you'll never do this again." Or the father didn't give one of those looks that I knew so well. That send that sense of guilt down the shiver of your spine. Nope. The father says, "Let's party." And then the older son is not so happy. I was going to use another word. He's angry. And he says, "You never threw a party for my friends." Now here is where I think we often miss this story. And here I think is the key to this theological shift from transactional faith to transformational faith. Both sons are separated from God, from the Father. Sorry. Both sons are separated from the Father. The younger son by his bad choices, the older son by his good deeds. The younger son leaves home and assumes that his destructive choices separate him from his father. Again, remember, he had just hoped to be in the servants' barracks. And the older son stays home, but assumes somehow that all of his good deeds will earn his father's favor. Both sons see the father as judging. Both sons see the father as keeping the scorecard, keeping track. You know, they're either points are added or points are deducted. Both sons see somehow that it is their actions that will determine the Father's favor. And that's what Jesus turns absolutely upside down. The Father welcomes the youngest son before he even opens his mouth, before he has a chance to apologize. The father puts a robe around him and puts rings on his fingers, which were symbols of being a son. So the father is essentially saying, "Welcome home, even though in my heart you never left. From my love, you can never be separated." And he puts the robe on and the rings on as if to say, "You know, you've always been my son. You're my son. You will always be my son. And there's nothing that can change the fact that you are my son." And to the older brother, who says, "You never even threw a party for me and my friends," the father says, "You have always been with me. Everything I have is yours." Okay, about two of you got the fact that that was a mic drop. because that's it. That's my favorite verse in the entire Bible. That changes everything. You are always with me. Everything I have is yours. So in other words, it's a sense that, okay, it's not what you do. It's not what you do, say, pray, believe that will earn God's favor, that will earn God's acceptance, that will earn God's love. You already live in the love that is always with you. So often we think, you know, if we just try harder, if we just say the right thing, if we just do the right thing, if we just get my beliefs right, that'll get me to heaven. What if we awakened to that which we can't really comprehend, that heaven is already in us? A transactional faith is if you do A for God, then God will do B for you. That's exhausting. You want to suck the joy right out of life? Because you can never do enough. And you always wonder, did I believe enough? Did I pray the right prayer? A transactional faith that says, you know, if you just do these things, say these things, believe these things, pray these things, and then do it a little more, then you will be loved, accepted. That couldn't be further from those words the Father says. You are always with me. Everything I have is yours. Not everything I have is yours if you. Everything I have is yours. Here's the transformational part. What if we worried less about how to get to heaven? Trusted the one who said, there is nothing that can ever separate you from my love. And what if we awakened that heaven is already in us? What if we just kind of slowed down this week? Just slow down this week, just slow down from thinking we have to do this and get this right and get my act together and blah, blah, blah. And just listen for that whisper in our soul. You are always with me. Everything I have is yours. I suspect then we start to live in that deep place. That deep place of peace where we find the joy in life of living in such a way that brings heaven to earth and that brings heaven to earth especially for those people who are experiencing a living hell. You are always with me. Everything I have is yours. For God's sake, let yourself be found in the love that is already yours. We continue to worship God as the morning offering is received.